Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Argentinians can count, some 30 million votes in a single night. But again, that's too big a hurdle in Cook County. We have last night's election results with about, 85% reporting last I saw in the Cook County State's Attorney's race, where retired Judge Eileen Burke holds about a 9,000 vote lead over Clayton Harris in that race. On the other big issue in Chicago, I would say, the Bring Home Chicago referendum, that appears to be going down. That's trailing by, the yes votes are trailing by some 30,000 votes. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Thank God for small victories, right? Or wrong?
Why? I mean, I pulled
right,
a double.
Right or wrong?
No, sorry, we're having a little technical issue here. Hold on. A lot of people, a lot of Republicans that I know, plugged our noses and had to go into the ballot or the election poll yesterday, or booth yesterday, and pull a Democratic ballot just to try and save Chicago.
Oh, and Eileen Burke is going to save Chicago. That's interesting.
No, I don't know. It's a start. She thinks she is. Here's her. Well, she thought she won, and then people declared her the winner. And then they're like, oh, there's 100,000 mail-in ballots that have to be counted.
There's more than that. There's more than that. There's votes that were cast yesterday that have to be counted. And from which wards are they coming? For example, in the city,
exactly,
where Clayton Harris won.
You know, there were a million reasons not to get into this race. And most people I talked to thought that this was really not something I should be doing. But I had a stubborn belief that I just couldn't shake. I believe that we could make our justice system work for everyone in every neighborhood, in every town across Cook County. That stubborn belief would have remained only a dream were it not for every single one of you. Because you shared my belief. You shared my vision for change.
Honestly.
I found mothers and fathers in coffee shops and in dining rooms across our city.
Are
they
we done
all
yet
worried
with
about
us?
The crime that's debilitating our county right now. I found new friends. I met people in every part of Cook County, and I drank way more coffee than was probably healthy.
I guess I wasn't clear. Are we done with this? Are we done with being shined on and being patronized?
What's our other choice, Clayton Harris?
That's not the question. I didn't say what our other choice was.
I can't hear you, but I can hear you now. Yes, what's the question?
I'm sorry, I'm not going to indulge in being patronized by political hacks like Eileen Burke. And that's not an endorsement of Clayton Harris, obviously. I'm not going to be shined on by the same rhetoric we've heard from the same politicians running for the same offices. You could cut and paste that bull jive unity speech and attach it to anybody who's won anything anywhere in Chicago for the last 40 years. And we're going to pretend what? I mean, I know Republicans crossed over to vote in the Democratic primary and it was difficult. And hooray, maybe. This is a maybe, by the way. 9,000 votes, depending on exactly where the votes are out and exactly what kind of effort was put into vote-by-mail programs by the public sector unions on behalf of Clayton Harris. That's a maybe at this point. But let's just say that Eileen Burke wins. We save the city. We stop the bleeding. What evidence do you have of that? Well, why is anything? First of all, you're looking at personnel rather than structure. The Safety Act makes the Cook County State's Attorney a lot less important than the Cook County State's Attorney used to be, doesn't it?
Well, the only difference between her and Clayton Harris is if you steal $300 worth of goods, you would be charged with a felony.
And you
as opposed to $1,000.
Right. And
that
and
is
people,
the only difference between those two.
I got it. And people think that a $700 difference on whether you charge misdemeanor or felony for retail theft is the linchpin for civilization in Chicago. That's where the turnaround begins. That's where the phoenix begins to rise from the ashes. I mean, come on.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Until you materially change the spoils of war mentality, and this is, I'm talking about the electorate, because these kleptocrats and the lessers that feign being our betters that we elevate into public office and leave there for 30 years unattended to. They're just a reflection of the electorate. Until you stop the spoils of war, tribal politics, or mute it down, you're never going to eradicate it altogether. But stop subscribing to it. And that includes Eileen Burke, who catered to the intemperate and ran the identity politics game just like Clayton Harris did, just like most everybody else does. Until you change that mentality, you will continue to see the disintegration of the city and the state. So we have these elections and people get all excited because it's an easy binary choice and you get to put a white hat on one person and a black hat on the other one, or or a black hat on one person and a black hat that's slightly lighter on the other person, most often the lesser of two evils kind of thing. And, oh, this is better than that. And what was our choice? What was the choice you tried to provide for yourself? What was the effort made to have a real choice, to present a real candidate, rather than these two nobody political hacks from nowhere who've done nothing and who are arguing over, I mean, in Gulliver's Travel style, Lilliputian style, arguing over which side of the egg to break? $300 or $1,000 for felony retail theft.
Yep, that's the difference between the two.
Wow.
Clayton Harris, oh, he's not giving up, Dan.
So we are going to count every single vote, and we're going to wait for this to come in.
Yeah, we're conceding defeat. We don't want the votes to be counted.
Every constituent, every community, everybody here in Cook County.
Right.
All
it's the
of
same
our
speech that Eileen
matter,
Burke just
so
gave.
So we're going to wait and we're going to count all the votes.
Ron on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, you are 100%. And when I heard that speech from Eileen Burke, it was just sickening to me.
You just heard the same speech from Clayton Harris. They have the same speechwriter. It was Daley's speechwriter, who was Rahm's speechwriter, who was Lightfoot's speechwriter, who was BLM Brandon's speechwriter, who was Tony Preckwinkle's speechwriter, who's John Stroger's speechwriter, who's Todd Stroger's speechwriter, who's Dick Phelan's speechwriter. How far do you want me to go back? I mean, yeah,
and I can
on.
Go back as far as with you, Dan. Hey, I'm 66 years old, so I haven't heard this garbage. But here's another thing. When they asked her, even though the threshold is supposed to be different for retail theft, they said, well, they asked her, what would she do as far as prosecuting? They said, well, you're not going to send them to jail. No. We're looking for some alternative. What the hell? What is that? Alternative what? Some more of these failing program. So, no, it's not a big difference, but I just have a real, real disdain. I made sure not to vote for anyone that the regular Democrat Party of Chicago teacher. I got to tell y'all one quick thing. I went to vote, and a gentleman was standing in front of a school. He said, you're a resident. I said, yes, I am. He said, well, I'm from the Chicago Teachers Union. I said, man, get out of my face. I was nice, but I said, you're standing in front of a school where the kids can't read and write? Oh, you all have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Jordan Antioch.
Good morning. Yeah, that doesn't affect us up here. I mean, we have our wonderful Eric Reinhart in Lake County. But the one thing I did notice about Bert, because we see all the ads up here, is, and I saw one like every 10 minutes. I swear, it was ridiculous. I noticed that while she wants to be the head law official in Cook County, where shootings are rampant, violent crime is rampant, and she wants to make $700 difference in stealing. And the one thing on her ad that she really pushed was she wants to put an abortion council in place at the state's attorney level so that they can prosecute those that harass people, women getting abortions. She's strong on abortion rights.
Wonderful.
And she wants to, yeah. And,
that's it.
And
that's it. Charging felonies maybe with retail theft crimes over $300. And pursuing suburban, rural, rural sidewalk prayer warriors like the FBI does. That's what's going to turn Cook County around.
Yeah, and the other thing that she was big on her ads, and I'm cynical about it, is that she wants to get illegal guns off the street, which to me...
Yeah, well, I've never heard that
who
before.
Who doesn't want to get illegal guns off the street?
Yeah.
But to me, she wants to go after the gun ban. Now,
well, of course she does. Thanks for the culture. Of course she does. I mean, do we have to explain this to each other? What this is? What do you think these Irish politicians, these Spoils of War Irish politicians, are so much different than the Spoils of War Black politicians or the Spoils of War Latino politicians? I mean... I love that. Has anybody lived in the city for 5 minutes? Text. This is a great text. Proverbs 26:11. As a dog returns to his own vomit, so a fool repeats his folly. And we should put that in the Welcome to Chicago sign.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Insight into what it means and the sharpest opinion. There's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, talking about yesterday's election results to the extent we have official results in certain races, like the Cook County State Attorney's race, where we don't. Expanding the circle out into the suburbs. Not much action. I mean, there was a little bit of sort of very modest challenges to incumbent congressmen, all of whom won going away. A couple of incumbent state reps lost in the city. I saw that. But, you know, again, it's, you know, replacing an old apparatchik like a Mary Flowers with a new one. So I don't know what that exactly accomplishes. Or
well,
why
poor Mary Flowers is out.
Yeah, she lost. Or why that's particularly interesting.
Because she was the big hope to try and change the laws in Springfield so that we could get rid of Brandon Johnson. But I guess that's over with.
The Bring Home Chicago referendum looks like that's failing. So I guess you get a reprieve. So if you have house worth more than $1 million, chop chop. So you get a temporary reprieve. But as I was saying, until you have real electoral competition and real arguments made about doing things differently, then that's all you're trying to do. I mean, the Bring Home Chicago referendum failing is very much like Pritzker's income tax increase referendum failing, and that did what exactly?
Well, now they're going to think of, they have to come up with new ways to tax us in order to house the homeless. That's what they're saying. You know, it's not over yet because now we're just going to have to recreate a new way to house the homeless.
Yeah, I know it's not over yet because they're going to continue doing what they do. But my point is to say this is some sort of important moment, watershed moment in changing out the power structure in the city or the state. Does anybody believe that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on this hot text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, I suppose they're more than Pyrrhic victories because they would have done substantive damage. The Bring Home Chicago would have been substantive damage to residential and commercial property owners with property that's more than $1 million bucks.
People who rent. I mean, people, it's everyone. Not only if you own a $1 million house, but people who rent, that would affect them. It'd affect businesses. And that's why I thought, you know, a lot of people, and then there was some rumor going around that it wasn't going to be on the Republican ballot. That initiative was on the Republican ballot, you know. But I think that's what motivated some people to vote. But voter turnout was, what, 20% yesterday?
Right. Yeah.
Horrible.
So there's really this rally to save Chicago, Cook County, Illinois. Right. Mm. It's not. It's all sort of people that are civic minded and feel a sense of duty to participate and interested parties in profiting from the system one way or the other. So it's slightly more than a Pyrrhic victory, but I mean, it just slows down the descent, right? People understand this, and that's not a ton to get excited about. In the suburbs, I would say the same thing. Graduated state income tax referendum failed. So Pritzker, that the suburbs revolted. And then they vote to reelect him and vote to reelect all his friends. And what's changed? Things are getting better in Illinois. I know Pritzker wants you to believe that there's virtually no evidence to support that claim, and there's a mountain of evidence to support the contrary claim. So these referenda in the suburbs, these bond issues, it was interesting to see in places like Wilmette, where you think that they are blank check oriented when it comes to their schools, that $75 million for their local school district, Avoca, that went down. It went down, I think, almost 3-1. Glenbar District 87, $180 million bond issue. I mean, these people. It's too close to call right now. The last I saw is it was passing by about 80 votes, you know, with mail-in ballots and so forth to be counted yet. So that's neck and neck. You wouldn't think so. You wouldn't think it would take the effort that it took to even get it to neck and neck in terms of organized opposition to this bond issue. We heard it from one of the organizers on our show who called in and talked a little bit about what they were doing up against, you know, the institutional interests, the potential vendors, and obviously the teachers union and the administrators all pouring money into the Yes campaign. And, you know, even though you say, well, gosh, in Glen Ellen, places like Glen Ellen and Lombard, and you can't even get people to stop this empire building by educrats and public sector union bosses. Yeah, well, it's, you know, these places have fallen away considerably. So it's painstaking to claw them back. This is why perhaps people should have been more vigilant on the front end. So that was interesting. I saw a Lockport bond issue go down. Even a Thornton Township tax increase to build, like, mental health facilities. Thornton Township, I saw that go down. That wouldn't have happened under the Z team, but I guess Tiffany Henyard has other priorities.
She had to get her hair done.
Probably. And
she had a meeting with her stylist.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. You know, I don't know. There's some signs of, I mean, I don't want to be completely fatalistic. I just want to be descriptive of the reality on the ground. And So there's some green shoots out there. There's, you know, some percentage of the people that are sensible, even if they're on the losing end, like potentially they would be in the Glenn Bard schools. But
oh, I wrote you in, by the way, as the fifth congressional candidate.
Oh, to replace Quigley, Danny Davis?
Well, no, no.
Oh, no, no.
Quigley. My
oh, Quigley. Wait, is...
Wait, is that fifth or
that's
ninth?
That's not fifth.
Oh, my God. Am I having a brain aneurysm? But anyway, I wrote you in because I didn't want to vote for... Because I had to pull a Democratic ballot, and I just didn't vote for a lot of people, but I wrote you in.
If elected, I...
What do you want to do?
...shall not serve. Yeah, I just as we were talking before Mike Scott's newscast, so there's this, you know, a minority of people that are commonsensical and play by the rules that see the same things that we see and that and some percentage of them are participating and providing enough of the lift to shoot down a bring home Chicago referendum or to shoot down some of these suburban referenda. But until you provide some fully formed opposition vehicle, then these are just one-offs where Republicans have to cross over to vote for the least noxious Democrat. Republicans have to come out to stop, to participate in stopping the big Bring Home Chicago referendum or the graduated state income tax because some billionaire said it's a bad idea or some trade association says it's a bad idea in the latter case. I mean, in the former case, in the Bring Home Chicago, you know, because the real estate agents mobilized and said this would be bad for business. I mean, that's just not enough to salvage the city, to stop the disintegration. And so I don't want to rain on anybody's feeling of relief that maybe we avoid a Clayton Harris and maybe somehow, some way, a political hack like Eileen Burke turns out to be a serious prosecutor. I doubt it. I think she'll be relegated to backdrop and we won't hear much from her. We won't pay much attention to her and the mayhem will continue unabated. That's what I predict.
I don't think she's going to win.
Well, she may. Yeah, right.
I mean, honestly, if she wins, I know, like, we have rigged elections. Don't say that. But something's going to happen. When she came out early and then they declared her and then they all took it back yesterday, I was like, screwed. And all of a sudden we have 100,000 mail-in ballots that we have to count.
Well, it's not all of a sudden. That's not all of a sudden. There was vote by mail programs. And I'm sure, even though there was much less enthusiasm for Clayton Harris than there was for like BLM Brandon, because there was so much more on the line for the teachers union and the public sector unions. Public sector unions, I mean, they run vote by mail programs. I mean, that's not out of the all of a sudden or unexpected. Okay. Number one. Number two. Yeah, I agree. And it's not clear to me where the outstanding votes are.
Right.
In Cook County, the 15% that have not reported yet. So if they're coming from black wards, then that 9,000 votes spread that Burke enjoys is going to dissipate quickly. But if she wins, even if she wins, the idea that this is going to begin some course reversal, I think, is just wildly optimistic based on no foundation.
And bring Chicago home. I mean, it's only being defeated by 23,000 votes right now.
Right.
And they're still tabulating, so I just wouldn't celebrate even on that.
That one, yeah. I mean, yeah, possibly. I probably goes down. But, I mean, the point is that something as bad an idea as that is that close. I mean, this is the point. Unless you can provide a vehicle for an opposition viewpoint that is articulated and relentlessly so, and has standard bearers that will run for office under the banner, then you're just trying to buy time before your time runs out.
Yeah, text message, Dan and Amy, it's too close. The mail-in ballots are going to screw it up for Burke.
Well, you know, again, in the low turnout elections and in the vote-by-mail era, organization matters. So whoever has the better organization in a close race, you would tend to say they have the advantage. And I suspect the public sector unions behind Harris provide him some advantage on that score. Jim in Warrenville.
Good morning. Dan, I think you're a little too optimistic about the failure of all these things, the come home Chicago and the bond issues, because all they do is they just keep bringing them back election cycle after election cycle with the hope that either they'll wear you down or they'll catch it in an off year where the number of votes are down, the number of voters that came out in opposition are down, and it'll squeak by. What Illinois really needs is some kind of a legislation that says, you know, you get two tries at it, and then after that, you have to wait 4 years before you can ask for more money. But you know that'll never happen. But I love your show, and I want to listen to you every morning. Thank you for the time.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah, I mean, he's definitely right that they come back again and again until they beat you into submission. That's true. Clay in Libertyville.
Morning, Dan. Amy, where are these tax increase referendums happening? We live in Illinois. I am getting water in taxes. I own my own small business. I own a house. I cannot, in any good conscience, understand how any kind of tax increase anywhere is even feasible for people. My insurance is skyrocketed 20% with zero claims. Cost of living is skyrocketed. Who in their right mind, sane mind, can vote for these tax increase referendums? I'm speechless, guys. Clay.
Why do you hate teachers? Why do you hate kids? Why don't you want kids to be educated?
What's the percentage of kids who are literate at their own reading level?
Clay, let's not get into the numbers, please.
Wait, silly. Can we just throw more money in it, Dan?
Yeah, I think
we try that.
I think that's what we should try. We should give it a shot. It's because it's for the kids. They deserve it, Clay. Thanks for the call. Marvin in Burlington.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Bruce Rauner was supposed to be the standard bearer. Bruce Rauner was going to stand up for conservative rights, and all he did was make Illinois a sanctuary state and make abortion okay for
We pay for abortions now.
Yeah, I mean, so what standard bearer? What it happens? People get so tired of you vote for the right person. And you still get stabbed in the back, so it's like it's like, what's the point?
Well, maybe you didn't. Maybe people didn't vote for the right person. I mean, thanks for the call. So, in order to have an organized opposition, you have to have an organizing principle. So, what is that for the Republican Party in Illinois specifically? By the way, there's good reason. Marvin in Burlington, he has every reason to vote Republican in Wisconsin. You're in play, so stay engaged there. But here. What's the organizing principle? I mean, I ask this, you know, intermittently when we're forced to bring up this vestigial two-party system in Illinois. I have no idea what it is, nor does anybody else. The organizing principle is follow me. It's a warlordocracy. Or here's the new shiny penny. And the ethos is... be transactional like the Democrats. Say one thing and then say the other thing 5 minutes, say the opposite thing 5 minutes later if that's what you think you need to do in order to stave off a coming attack or appeal to a certain constituency. How's that worked? And the two legislative leaders we have in the super minority positions in the General Assembly exactly fit that profile. Most of the candidates I see and have seen over the last couple cycles exactly fit that profile. So until these center-right voters that like to complain about Democrats and some of these rhinos, like you just heard from Marvin, until they decide that they're interested in organizing an opposition party around a discernible principle with people who are willing to fight on that basis, you know, fight intellectually and electorally on that basis, then we're going to continue having these conversations after every primary and every election until, well, I don't know, until there's too few people left in Illinois of that disposition to have any sort of conversation. That seems to me where it's at. I mean, from Vallis to Burke to God knows what is coming after this. You know, with Pritzker up for re-election in 2 years.
And I know, he's already putting out campaign ads everywhere. It's so weird.
Well, sure, because he'll walk to re-election, and then he begins his presidential campaign for 2028. That's what's going to happen.
And I laugh. I mean, people laugh, but he's doing it.
That's precisely what's going to happen.
Coming down the pipe.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, talking about all that's going on in and around the border and our larger border security and immigration policy debates. We've got this burgeoning crisis in Haiti that we've talked about quite a bit over the last week, as that country has unfortunately descended into warlordocracy and chaos yet again. And you're talking about the possibility the Biden administration would use Guantanamo Bay as a processing center, way station for Haitians that are fleeing that their country.
Well, we should start with the Americans. There's some 1,000 plus Americans that want to get out of Haiti. And this morning, there's talk of them helicoptering them into Dominican Republic and then getting them home safely. But these are things he knew this was coming. You know, for 18 months, he could have gotten them out before. But okay, it's like Afghanistan all over again.
Yeah, Representative Corey Mills can't do everything. Federal government is going to have to help a little bit too. But you also have the issue, though, that Florida has been scrambling border security resources for its border. Governor DeSantis says, in anticipation of flotillas emanating from Port-au-Prince and trying to make landfall in America, seeking asylum. And in this case, you have legitimate asylum claims in many instances. If the federal government doesn't do anything, Ron DeSantis is renewing his vow to send Haitian migrants to Martha's Vineyard, his old friends in Martha's Vineyard, so they can enjoy some exposure to migrants for a day before they kick them out again.
They can make new pen pals, Dan.
Yeah, have their lives changed very briefly one more time. But just on that score, what the Dominican Republic is doing, since, you know, those are the two countries there in Hispaniola, and it's... there's a border between the two. Very different situations in Dominican Republic versus Haiti. And what the Dominican Republic is doing in sort of responding, just like American governors were, or just like a federal government would if we had a serious federal government. Here's the Fox News Channel down in the Dominican reporting on what they're seeing the Dominicans doing.
The crisis has fueled fears of another Haitian migrant exodus in the U.S. and here in the Dominican Republic. The DR has built a 12-foot-tall border wall to protect them from gangs and crime. They call it a smart security fence with drones and cameras, night vision, and watchtowers. Yesterday, we drove in dune buggies along the border with Haiti's with a commander of CESFRONT, the Dominican Republic's Border Patrol. Construction of this new border wall began last year. The president of the Dominican Republic says so far about 100 miles of border wall has been completed. The goal is to eventually have a border wall run along the entire border with Haiti. He says it'll change the Dominican Republic forever.
La parte física.
The physical wall is already doing its job. From a security standpoint, it is helping us a lot. Meantime, the DR is also doing their deportations. In fact, every day, truckloads of illegal Haitians are dropped off at the border. They've received international criticism for this, but the government here says it is necessary for law and order.
Really? It's having a positive impact. It's necessary for law and order. Huh. Interesting. And I'm glad to hear that because I'd like to get back down to Punta Cana because I want to play Teeth of the Dog again.
Well, that's right. You want another shot at it, huh?
Yeah, I didn't play great when I played.
Yeah. You're a new man now.
Yes. And so, so that's what I'm thinking of. And so I'm glad the Dominicans are on the job. Oh, it's just interesting. Interesting that people of color, that would be the Dominicans, are similarly disposed to honkies like a DeSantis and Abbott. Don't you find that interesting when it comes to protecting their country and their countrymen? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro,
well,
text line.
Every day they round up Haitians in the Dominican and then send them back. They're not vetting them. They're not getting any government, social services. They put them on a bus and they drive them back to Haiti and then they let them off on the bus.
And what are the people of color that represent the political power structure in Chicagoland doing to protect the marginalized communities they talk about so much? Huh. Well, this story. Just have to tell stories.
Oh, no. Is there more? Do we have to add names to the list?
A trans woman, that's a man, got to translate the reporting on this, of course. Trans man, a woman.
Okay.
I mean, excuse me, a man. That is being termed a trans woman. That's a man. You got to get your glossary of terms out. Recently migrated from Venezuela, waiting for a ride outside a Little Village nightclub when a driver pulled up, made a ominous remark in Spanish that was translated to bad gay, and then fired three shots at the dude around 4:30 a.m. at this club, V Live, in Little Village. Didn't V Live used to be in Logan Square?
I thought so.
Because I remember I used to go there with Sammy Sosa. We danced bachata.
Oh, that's right. Back in the day when you guys were so close.
Back when.
In the home run derby.
So
McGuire, yeah.
The dude was struck in the groin, both legs, left in critical condition. So these serious injuries.
Yeah,
well, it's a
no
serious crime. You open fire on somebody. So detectives honed in on a 29-year-old Venezuelan linked to a drug cartel by federal authorities. Of course, with the help of a Marshall's task force, officers took him into custody on February 26th. He had also been hit with a list of charges a couple of days earlier, including felonies for illegally possessing a gun and ammo, according to court records. The judge, of course, immediately released him because that's what we do here under the Safety Act.
Yeah.
And then he was arrested again, brought in for questioning. While he had been identified as the gunman and police had recovered key evidence, including a shell casing and video of the Ford Explorer used in the attack, that's pretty good evidence. Cook County prosecutors wouldn't bring charges.
Oh, really? Why?
They're not protecting the
trans community, Dan.
The case has been continued for additional investigation. No charging decision made at this time. One of our witnesses who could possibly identify the gunman was uncooperative, they said. And the victim stopped cooperating because he believed he was targeted for being a sex worker and fears the suspect's association with, here we go again, El Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang. that's into human trafficking and drugs and obviously violence by extension. So the organizer in Little Village, whatever that is, said, do we blame the police department or do we blame the state's attorney? Boy, I think there's plenty of blame to go around here. But my point is to say, so you have a Venezuelan gangbanger in this country illegally who opens fire on a dude pretending to be a woman that's part of a marginalized community, according to the left, whose status, by the way, is unclear based on the reporting. This guy's outside a nightclub. He gets shot three times. The cops arrest him. So how do you blame the cops? Prosecutors don't charge him. Witnesses stop cooperating. And now you've brought, you know, third world cartel lifestyles into more prominence than they already are in Chicago. So that is accomplished exactly what? The marginalized community, quote unquote, not getting any safer. The larger community not getting any safer. And the Chicago police not getting any less frustrated, I suspect. This is like such a great case study in what happens when you just say, nah, anything goes. Anything goes, and we're going to make decisions based on your identity, not based on your behavior. We don't like the rule of law because it doesn't let our friends do what they want. Then we just suspend the rule of law, or we rewrite the law to make it more permissive, as was done in Illinois.
And nobody's vetting anybody. I mean, in O'Fallon, Missouri, some dude, I don't even want to say his name. His name's Jose, whatever. I just said his name. He entered the country illegally in Eagle Pass, Texas in 2021. He stabbed two people at a laundromat in O'Fallon, Missouri. So you think you're not a border state or a border town? You are now. Oh, and by the way, Barrera, this guy, he killed people with a machete in Honduras. Letting in the finest, huh?
Tony, Downers Grove.
Well, now, these are just isolated incidents. Hey, Dan, how come France is not mentioned when Haiti's brought up? I mean, didn't they kind of start the whole mess, and yet they're off the hook? Of course, the United States gets blamed for intervening after that, but it seems to me that some of the original colonizers never get blamed for any of this crap, but there they are.
You're always on strong. You're always on safe footing to blame the French. Yes, very good, Tony.
Yes, and they refuse to help because we asked them.
Hey, Dan, I have a question about the elections. I know you talked about it, but I missed it. I went to the polling booth yesterday, and it's like Nikki Conforti. I mean, that's the best that we can do against Sean Casson. She got 12% of the vote the last time she ran in a primary, and that's it. That's all we had to offer. So I see where this is going to go again. Anyway, have a good day.
Thanks for the call. Well, as I said, all the best we can do. Who's the we? And what are the we doing? Can we be more specific about the we? I love the we, the generic we and the generic they. I don't know. I mean, what did I do about that race? Well, nothing. What did Tony and Downers Grove do about it? What did anybody else do about it? What did anybody else do about it last time when Peacock was running? Probably more participation. Or the time before when Jeannie Ives was. So you had a couple of shots with quality candidates. And what happened?
What happened?
And after a couple of shots with quality candidates, what happens? They see how quality candidates are supported, and they say, well, I don't want any part of that, so you lose your pool of quality candidates. And now, with this complete lack of any sort of party organization to lean on, even if I'm a quality candidate, quality person, then I've got to do all of this by myself in most cases where, you know, I'm not a political operative. I don't have a background in being a political operative and running political campaigns. I don't pretend to know, you know, all the players and the topography and the mechanics of campaigns. See, that's why you need a functioning political party. If you don't have a functioning political party, you don't get quality candidates. You get people who fly in and fly out, you know, billionaire dilettantes like Bruce Rauner who want to do something, you know, for their epitaph. They fly in, they fly out. They want to wear a sash. Jelly Belly Pritzker is another example of that. But they've got infrastructure. That's the difference. and they've got other candidates. And he spends his ill-gotten gains through inheritance on those other candidates. Mm-hmm. So this is the best we can do. That's a phrase I hear a lot. And so, again, I just want you to think about who the we is and what are they doing. Franklin in McHenry. Hey, Franklin.
Dan, I understand that there's a great need for landscapers and housekeepers in Martha's Vineyard. So once they get there and they register to vote, they'll be able to go to work.
Yeah, well, based on our previous experience with Martha's Vineyard residents, they are not interested.
No.
So,
hi, how are you? When are you leaving?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the greatest thing ever DeSantis did.
Bill Malusian reporting. I wrote along with the Los Angeles-based ICE deportation officers early this morning as they arrested several convicted felons with lengthy criminal histories who are all in the U.S. illegally. Of course they are. They expressed frustration with the California L.A. sanctuary policies, telling me they use their limited manpower to prioritize targeting public safety threats, and sanctuary policies make the job more difficult. ICE says one of the felons they arrested yesterday had been previously released from local custody without notice after their detainer request wasn't honored due to sanctuary policy. Right, it's a story we know very well in Chicago and Cook County. I'm sorry, did Eileen Burke have something to say about the sanctuary county policy?
No.
Yeah, right. Phil and Darian.
Hey, good morning, guys. Listen, we're talking about quality candidates. Dan, you guys got to agree. I don't care what candidate you put out there. It's just not going to happen. We're outnumbered. It is what it is. We're outnumbered. It ain't going to happen in this state. Keith Pikow, that's not a quality candidate? Oh, yeah, that was a quality candidate. It just ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
Period.
Well, Phil, thanks for the call, Phil, but we weren't always outnumbered. So when you see, you know, we look around and see what is. Did you ever ask how we got here? We weren't always outnumbered. We had, quote unquote, Republican governors and Republican constitutional officers, even a Republican senator back in the day named Peter Fitzgerald.
Yeah, I remember that.
A Republican senator named Mark Kirk.
Yeah.
So maybe, again, some reflection on the choices the Republican Party made over that period where it did technically enjoy majority status in Illinois. I mean, it's not that long ago. It's been a long time since Illinois went for a Republican presidential candidate, 1988. But even over that time period, as Illinois has sped towards the abyss, there have been many opportunities. And what did we do? How did we get to the place where we're so outnumbered? Or more to the point, what we didn't do. I mean, I've gone through this many times. Every time, every moment, every time there was an opportunity to make a paradigm shift in the Republican Party, Republican primary voters made the wrong choice. And I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about, for example, when Jeannie Ives ran in the Republican primary against Bruce Rauner in 2018 for governor and narrowly lost. There was a choice to repudiate an incumbent governor who had backstabbed the party and set a new course of conservative reform as the organizing principle for the party. That was just 6 years ago. And there are choices before that we could have made, too. We didn't. We continually and relentlessly chose the combine play. And it turns out the other side's better at it. So they just enveloped us. And that's why we're outnumbered. So don't tell me how we're outnumbered now. Tell me what the we did over the last 40 years to put us in this position and what we all, Republican Party regulars, precinct captains and committeemen, primary voters, what we did or didn't do over that same time frame when we had opportunities to do or not do something different. Tom in Schererville.
Yeah, seeing that the Clintons have a special relationship with Haiti, maybe some of the illegal Haitians in Florida should be sent to Chappaquiddick. They'd be kind of like a reunion.
I like that. It's Chappaqua, but close enough. We can send some to the Kennedys, too.
Clintons went on their honeymoon there. So romantic. Yeah. Oh, my God.
And the Clinton Foundation raped and pillaged Haiti.
Yes, they sure did.
For personal profit to, you know, funnel money to Hillary Clinton's presidential ambitions through
George
that
C3. Soros was there, too. Yep.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. I like that a lot, actually. Joe in Naperville.
Yeah, the Haitian thing is a classic example of why the Democratic policies fail. In other words, just throw more money at it. Didn't the Clinton Foundation give like billions of dollars to Haiti? And look what
Hillary Clinton did through via the State Department. It was $4 billion, and I don't know what's to show for that $4 billion.
It doesn't matter where how it got there. The bottom line is it got there. And boy, did it really make that big of a difference for the good?
I mean, it's when you talk about poverty and garbage, it's indescribable. I've never seen anything like it.
So is the answer no to Joe's question then?
Well, nothing. I mean, there's nothing to show. I don't know who pocketed the $4 billion, but nothing changed in Haiti. Nothing.
By the way, I would just as a quick postscript, we have the Supreme Court. Staying essentially of the Fifth Circuit decision that would prevent Texas from implementing the law that was passed and signed by Governor Abbott to allow Texas law enforcement to effectively serve as border agents to arrest for criminal trespass and move for deportation people in Texas illegally, people coming across the border illegally. So the Supreme Court, this is their way to get the Fifth Circuit to pick up the pace and adjudicate the case. It was not decided on the merits, so there's some over exuberance on Twitter about the Texas law being protected by the Supreme Court as it being allowed to be implemented by the Supreme Court, as if that's indicative of their decision on the merits, which it is not. It is not. And I still think that this Texas law is not going to stand. But I will say I was surprised that they actually allowed it to be implemented pending Supreme Court review. But regardless, the larger point, I just want to go back and remind people of the argument that Greg Abbott was making here, because it seems to me that it's unlikely to hold up under scrutiny given Supreme Court precedent. But the fact that the Supreme Court is allowing implementation pending the Fifth Circuit's full adjudication of the case is interesting. It almost seems to me like it's an indication they find Abbott's argument at least intriguing. So essentially, again, to remind people, it's two provisions of the Constitution. Article 4, Section 4, that triggers Article 1, Section 10. And Article 4, Section 4, relates to the federal government's responsibility to protect the states from invasion. And Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, reserves the right of the state to self-defense if the federal government fails to protect it from invasion. That's the sum total of it in a couple of sentences. And I just find the... I know there's some confusion and there's too much excitement on one side and too much doom and gloom on the other, because everybody lives and dies, you know, with their hearts on their sleeves these days rather than trying to understand what's actually happening in terms of the distribution of justice here. But it's just interesting that you may have a Supreme Court break with precedent on immigration law, and if they did, it would seem to me that it's as much a practical it would be much out of a basis in practicality as it would in sort of constitutional philosophy. It's just a really interesting case here, and people should be following this and paying attention to it, because obviously it has potentially huge implications if the Supreme Court were to break from precedent with respect to immigration. This is how far the federal government has fallen in terms of its responsibilities to the states.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we've spent much of the first part of today's show talking about yesterday's election results, such as they are official. And that necessarily brings up the issue of the seeming lack of any sort of organized opposition party in Illinois, such that Republicans are left to prostrate themselves before Democrats. Oh, we have to somehow rally the troops for Eileen Burke, or rally the troops for Paul Vallis, or rally the troops for other candidates, for candidates that are in the other party in places where the Republican Party is not competing or relevant, which, you know, frankly, is large swaths of the state. Well, there's an organization called Souris Illinois, and it put out a release yesterday that 17 of its local Republican Party organization partners around the state have received financial support from donors in recognition toward the priorities of the BATTLE program. And the BATTLE program is to offer local county and township Republican Party organizations essentially planning and operational support through voter data, through the provision of voter data and modeling of voter data, easy-to-use voter contact technology, marketing and comms resources, strategic guidance. So it's the sort of to replace the on-again, off-again consultant class with sort of institutional resources for local party organizations to actually build their local party organization into something that is functional and purposeful. The founder, and by the way, the goal of Souris Illinois, which is sort of a blue sky goal, I would argue, is to turn Illinois red. So not everybody has completely given up hope or given up hope at all, apparently. And one of them is the founder of Souris Illinois, an entrepreneurial approach to politics. He is Barrett Davey, and Barrett joins us now. Barrett, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, pleasure.
Hi.
Souris, was that Hannibal's war elephant? Is that where you got the name?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it definitely germinated after maybe a few drinks, but
yeah.
To your point about a blue sky goal, I mean, I think, you know, at least my business partner and I thought, all right, if we're going to turn Illinois red, which seems like a pretty audacious goal, what would be an audacious name in support? And Souris was Hannibal's longest living war elephant when he crossed the Alps and crushed the Romans in the Second Punic War in 218 BC. So we thought if someone could take an elephant over the Alps and win a war, you know, maybe we ought to pay some homage. So that's where Souris came from.
No, I mean, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole or the elephant hole of world history, but ultimately, weren't the Romans successful in the Second Punic Wars?
It was actually the next conflict where the Romans prevailed, but in the second,
right?
So I think Hannibal was able to walk on the field with some victory, at least temporarily.
All right. Well, we'll take you in temporary victories these days in Illinois. So tell us, tell us what the program is, and are you building actual rebuilding local organizations, or are local organizations sort of rebuilding themselves at the grassroots level, and then you're there to provide this sort of menu of services?
Yeah, so I appreciate that. The kind of distinction, but if you don't mind, I'm going to take us back just a minute to kind of what the impetus for this was. I mean, as you remember, I ran in 2018 for state senate in the 29th district north of Chicago, and I went all in on that race and spent, you know, 60, 70 hours a week for a year, which I think oftentimes most people who are running for a state ledge seat or something like that, they, I mean, they've got a day job, they're doing other things, and I was able to spend the time, and I think in doing that, you really start to uncover, you know, what's going on. I mean, you start to see the systemic problems that I think most people just skim across the surface and don't see. And so CERIS was initially at least meant to look at those problems around a lack of a farm system, a lack of, you know, true day-to-day local, always-on political machinery on the Republican side, you know, a decaying capital market. I mean, we know that we have a couple of, you know, really large, supportive, incredible donors in the state of Illinois who are great patriots, but when you dug in, what you saw was that, you know, there used to be 200 or 300 of those donors back in the mid-90s to the early 2000s, and I think between 2013 and 2023, 93 cents of every dollar donated to Republicans in the state of Illinois came from three human beings. So you start to realize, okay, we've got no cap market, people have lost faith, and then there's no infrastructure, there's no tech, no data, no nothing that's built that grows and gets smarter every cycle. You just keep coming back, and you mentioned the consulting class. I mean, you know, I've met a couple of decent folks, but I've met a lot of folks who, you know, it's just a hamster wheel. It's just wash, you know, rinse, repeat, and always rebuilding. And the other thing is most people are always focused on campaign. The reality is if you're running a campaign, you know, every other year, you step on the field on the 3-yard line with your foot in your own end zone, your chances of scoring a touchdown are like 1 in 20. So if somebody would actually spend some time and do the same actions in like January of 2023 as you would, you know, be asking people to do in maybe August of 2024 in a cycle, and you were doing those actions every month, you know, touching people, building relationships, engaging them, you know, dropping information on them, connecting with them. The drip campaign that the left is engaged in through their issues advocacy groups all the time, that you would begin to shift the engagement level of our voter base. Because the reality is, if you look at the voter turnout numbers over the last 30 years in Illinois, the enemy, almost in many respects, is apathy. And you have this just decay. And unfortunately, there's nothing out there that's inspiring these local folks to do the work. And so when we got involved, and we don't have all the answers, Dan, we make mistakes all the time and break eggs and upset apple carts. But what we do know is that there's lots of good people out there in all these local areas who want to do work, but nobody's paying attention and nobody's supporting them. And so we literally started going county by county and township by township, and now even regions inside the city of Chicago, and said, okay, you know, tell us what you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, it really gets down to, you've got a basket of voters, some of whom are Republicans and they vote all the time, some of whom are Republicans but are unreliable, they only vote some of the time, and then there's a lot of persuadables. And in that second bucket, I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of voters in Illinois who we call turnout Republicans, who, hey, when I vote Republican, but I don't always vote. And so if these organizations had one job to do, it would be to go out and talk to those people and do it all the time. I mean, every 30 to 60 days, you know, measuring and managing and reporting on the process of having conversations with people in these communities. And so that's where the battle program came from, is we just started a process. And it's not rocket science, but it requires discipline and focus and managing and measuring and reporting, and it requires money. And so we've begun to build that infrastructure out across the state. And I could go on and on, but I'm sure you got some questions there.
Well, you're getting buy-in, from what I know about CERIS and you, and what I see from the communiques you put out. You're getting buy-in from the smaller donor, and not an insubstantial amount of money either. But I mean, the $1,000, the $5,000, the $10,000 donor, which adds up. But you have to, as you were saying, you have to build financial capacity. You can't just rely on one or two individuals to fund the whole thing all the time.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, what we found was that, first of all, this doesn't cost a lot of money, right, ultimately. And, you know, there's always this, you know, this knock on anybody who tries to come in and do something new, as I'm sure you've experienced, you know, or who are these guys and, you know, how are they trying to make money off the system? And I can assure you, it's pretty hard to make money off of state politics. So it is definitely a mission-driven organization. But I would say some of the hardest work has been to actually engage and build rapport and then relationship and then trust with a donor community, that, you know, an entrepreneurial community, a business community, a group of people in Illinois who are so frustrated, right? They're so tired of, you know, the continued decay that they're either, you know, 6 month in a day crowd, they're living in Florida, they're living in, you know, Wyoming or Tennessee or other places. And yeah, they still have a foot in the state, but they've kind of tried to figure out how to get out of here. Or, you know, yeah, they're still here, but they'd rather give their money to federal candidates or other, you know, activities. And so what we've done over the last couple of years is we've built a community. And there's a community out there of folks now, part of a group called the Citizen Farmers, that we've supported the growth of. And it's entrepreneurs and business leaders from around Illinois. And to your point, they're the $1,000, the $5,000 crowd. And that group of people is getting engaged, and we have hundreds of them now. And the goal is to talk to them every 7 to 10 days and share results and be accountable and create transparency and to make sure that, you know, they pay attention to what's going on in their local communities, and to the organizations that are supposed to be doing this work well in advance of a campaign cycle. And so that's a big part of this too, is revitalizing trust with those folks. And that's a ton of work, and that's a process. And our experience has been that we have tried to share this journey with anybody who wants to listen. We talk, and it's funny. I mean, we get rocks thrown at us from folks, you know, that are party people. We get rocks thrown at us by people that call themselves quote unquote grassroots people. You know, I laugh about it all the time. I'm always available to talk to anybody, and so is our team. We have a great team now of about 12 full-time people doing this work, and, you know, and there are a lot of young folks, and they work really hard, and they care deeply. They're not running away. They've got kind of a first responder attitude, and we're sitting here going, hey, look, if you're interested in what we're doing and you want to learn more about it, we'd love to talk to you. And you know, a big thing, and it gets back to something you said earlier, you know, why do this? Why do this in Illinois? You know, I'm not Don Quixote here, you know, so, I mean, we looked at the numbers early on back in, you know, not 2019 after my 18 race. We hired a PhD in data science. We did some research. We dug into who the people are that live in Illinois. And, you know, our research told us, after asking kind of a battery of questions, you know, our research told us that the people of Illinois are really like a 54-46 R-plus state on issues and values. But if you leave them alone for 30 years and you don't engage them, and the left drips on them constantly, you know, on their pet issues, you wake up and you see a voter base that votes 54-46 the other way, right? And so I'm not saying we can flip the switch and solve this problem. We get people that call all the time and kind of, you know, demand action and results in this election cycle or that election cycle. I'm saying that you have to be in for the long haul here, and you have to, you know, measure progress over time. And I don't know, Dan, I mean, anything I've ever done in life that's been, you know, really fulfilling has been hard. It's like putting in the reps, you know, building muscle memory around stuff. And so that's what Cirrus is about. That's what this battle program is about. It's about inviting people to participate in something where they're going to have to do some work, but they're going to have an opportunity to build strong relationships in their communities. They're going to have an opportunity to actually measure and manage and celebrate their success. And ultimately, they're going to start to win elections. And we've seen it, you know, in through the last 4 years. We have, you know, some significant success metrics around some small local races. We've been involved. CIRS has been involved so far in, you know, every House and Senate flip since 2020 that's happened. You know, there have been four of them. You know, we've been involved in a lot of things where we think this type of work day in, day out has, you know, over time, it'll lead to the turnaround we want to see here in the state of Illinois. So,
all right. Local organizations, local Republicans, and Republicans in Illinois, and part of local organizations. If you're not familiar with Cirrus Illinois, then get familiar with them. There's Barrett Davey extending the offer. Cirrus Illinois, Cirrus Illinois.com is the website for contact information and to avail yourselves of the services that Barrett and his team are providing. Barrett Davey, founder of Cirrus Illinois, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. Thank you very much. You guys are great. I appreciate you both.
Good idea. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Cook County State Attorney's race, still too close to call, as Mike Scott's been reporting. 99% of precincts reporting, and you've got about a 9,000-vote lead for retired Judge Eileen Burke with about 100,000 mail-in votes to count.
To be precise, 109,000 mail-in ballots mm-hmm. have to be counted, which I don't think is going to fare well for Burke.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Yeah.
I think that's probably right.
And bring Chicago home, it's only 23,000-vote difference, so that could go a different way, too, with these mail-in ballots. I wish we could do old school like we used to have, just Election Day.
Back in the good old days.
Yes.
Yeah, right, simpler times. Well, it wasn't so close for some of these, although it was, for some school referendum, like in District 87, which is less than 90 votes as last reporting with mail-in ballots to be counted there. That's 187 million dollar bond issue there, just massive. In Wilmette, Illinois, part of Neutra Township, part of the enlightened class, the smartest, richest, most talented people the world has ever seen.
Because they let you know.
That's how we know.
They tell you.
Yeah, that's how we know. And the posture has usually been, I mean, there have been some exceptions over the year, I recall. Occasionally a nuclear referendum goes down, probably because it wasn't big enough, then it's made bigger, it's put on the ballot again the next cycle, and it passes. But it's rare when a school referendum goes down, and by the margin it did in the local school district in Wilmette, which is Avoca, it's like 3-1 against. Look, I don't want to level the charge that normally would come from the League of Women Voters or the local union. But, I mean, what happened? Wilmette doesn't care about kids anymore? Doesn't care about schools? Is not interested in having the best education for the best and the brightest? I'm positively nonplussed, as you can imagine. To help us understand what the hell is going on in Wilmette, we're pleased to be joined by Christina Burke, who is a Wilmetian, as I understand it, and was involved in opposing this referendum. In fact, I think she was one of the leaders of the opposition to this bond issue. Christina, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
What gives?
So just to, first of all, just to let everyone know, so it is a school. The Avoca district covers four different suburbs within our area: Glenview, yeah, Northfield, Wilmette, and Winnetka. So it's a pretty diverse group as far as homes and neighborhoods in that way. We learned about this referendum, and it was actually three people who had started looking into it once it was announced and saw what some of the implications were and exactly what they wanted to do. And little by little, people started talking to each other and a group formed. And we just started doing our research to learn more about what was going on. And a lot of people thought there were just too many unanswered questions. And we just didn't feel like we had enough information to make an informed decision, because there were so many unanswered questions. Also, the bond was for $89.8 million, and we thought that was a lot of money for such a small school district. We have less than 700 children in our entire district. The new building they wanted to build is less than 400 children in that particular building. And so we wanted to, we thought that we just didn't have enough answers to understand why it needed to cost that much money. And as far as safety is concerned, of course, we care about our children's safety. The school, I mean, if I could go back, what they really wanted to do was to close a little school, the school of Avoca West, which is in the Glenview part of the district, and rebuild a new school over in the Wilmette part of the district. And we did the tours of the school, and we saw it. We just didn't feel that that it was warranted to build a new building at this point.
And they did. They wanted to be like walking distance to the beach, or why? What was the need to move to Wilmette?
They just, what they said was that the building at Avoca West was old, and that they it was too expensive to update it, and that it would just basically just be pushing the you know, ball down the road. To have to do it down later on. And when we looked at the school and a lot of the schools in our area, those schools are even older than ours, and they are refurbishing them, and the children are learning fine there. So why they want to move it over to Murphy, we don't know exactly all the facts on what prompted that. They do want to sell the property that the school is on right now. And which was another concern for us, especially the people who live here in this area, because we don't know what would go in there. There was some talk of a right of first refusal. I'm sorry?
No, like maybe like a casino or a marijuana dispensary.
Well,
yeah.
No. Well, we just don't know. I mean, we are a residential area, but, you know, we just weren't sure. And that was something else that gave us pause, because they really couldn't tell us what the possibilities were of what would go on that piece of property. They told us what they would like to go in there, but they couldn't guarantee that, and they couldn't tell us what the other options could be. And so that, I think, gave a lot of people pause as well.
And we're talking big money. I mean, if you have a $600,000 home, it would have been almost $2,000 more a year and $44,000 over the 25-year duration of the bond.
Yes.
That's a lot of money.
And
wow.
It is a lot. It is a lot of money.
You can't put a price tag on education.
So it is a lot of money, and we, you know, and as you can imagine, because we do draw from Winnetka and Wilmette and Northfield, that some of the homes are significantly more, you know, have a higher value than $600,000, and those homes we're looking at, you know, upwards of $12,000 to $15,000 tax increase per year for 25 years. So I do think that was a big motivator for people to come out and vote yesterday. And also we have seniors on fixed incomes. They've lived here for 40, 50 years. They've raised their children here. This is their home. This is their entire life was here. Much of their adult life was here. And, another tax increase, could cause them to have to think about moving. And so that was another concern for people. So there were a lot of different reasons, I believe that people came out to vote yesterday.
Yeah, 3-1 margin is sizable. So especially on a bond issue with all the sort of good feeling that schools usually have in the community, too, because it's clearly a repudiation of the leadership of the school, at least their judgment call on this one. And I wonder if you and others have now change your view of the leadership of this school district, the school board, as well as the administrators. They were so far afield from where the electorate is. And as you said, you listened, you heard them out, you took a look at what they were suggesting, and it didn't make any sense to you. So what does that say about the leadership of the school district and maybe the need to see change there?
Yes, so there has been some talk. There's definitely obviously was talk about that, and people, once they started seeing this information, really questioning that, because it looked from some of the information that the feedback that the school board got, it, you know, they knew that people that there was evidence that people did not want this particular option that was offered, and they went with it anyway. And I don't know if they just didn't calculate, just how much people would be against something like this. But yes, I think there definitely needs to be a discussion with them, and some evaluation, and people deciding where we go from here with regard to that. But it's important to stay on top of these things. I think that's something we've definitely learned, the entire group, that we need to really pay attention to what our local government officials are talking about and decisions that they're making, and working to stay more informed.
Yeah, that is a good takeaway. Christina Burke is a parent up in Wilmette in the Avoca School District. She was one of the leaders in the opposition to the bond issue referendum that went down by a remarkable 3-1 yep. margin last night. Christina Burke, thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations on your win.
Thank you so much. And I just want to thank everyone who worked so hard on this group. We had an amazing group of people that worked tirelessly hours and hours to get the vote out. Just want to make sure everybody knows it was a very strong group effort.
Good. Thank you so much. Keep up the good work. Don't go to sleep. Keep that group functioning. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the reviews continue to pour in of what's going on in New York City. Both with the Alvin Bragg case, which is yet to take form, but more notably with the Letitia James case, in which Trump has this $454 million bond he has to post in order to appeal this absurd punishment that has been imposed upon him.
And what, are they going to seize his assets? If he doesn't pay it, that's what they're talking about.
Well, that's what Letitia James has suggested. Yeah, the lien his assets at once he is falls into a state of tardiness on the payment. Jonathan Turley, George Washington law professor, imploring the higher courts to step in here and restore some order.
Basically, his position is, in order to get any other judge to look at what I've done to you, you've got to come up with basically $500 million just to appeal. It's like a judge saying, I'm going to take your house away, but you can appeal my decision. You just have to sell your house in order to do it. Many people look at this as a type of almost mob justice, as, the attorney general ran on bagging Trump. She's now pledging to seize his property just because he can't come up with his bond. At some point, the courts have got to step in and say, look, this is just simply enough. Yeah. You're requiring this astronomical bond just for this guy to be able to get any other judge to look at this decision.
Sure. Kevin O'Leary, real estate developer, you know him from Shark Tank. He's been very outspoken on this issue. It's difficult to like a real estate developer, but sort of like an attorney. But O'Leary has become a little bit more likable in the last couple of weeks as he has weighed in. And he went further than Turley.
But more importantly, the message about the American brand. You think about America, the reason this is the number one economy on earth is that we have laws and we have due process and we have property rights. It attracts foreign capital from all around the world. All of that is being shaken to the core here. The concept of seizing assets in 30 days on a bond number that's never been issued. No insurance bond company's ever issued anything near this. So it was no chance it was going to happen. And only giving 30 days notice and time. That's a really bad message. And I think New Yorkers should think well past Trump, whether he's president or not, or whether this attorney general is gone in 4 years or not, it's irrelevant. This is case setting against the American brand. Mm-hmm. the most stable country on earth anywhere to put capital to work over a long period of time, particularly in real estate, is the United States of America. This is an assault on what we believe to be core. And I find it extraordinary. I think it's very troubling. It has absolutely nothing to do with Donald Trump at this point, in my view. And it is completely bipartisan. This is an attack on America. Hmm. And I don't know how...
An attack on America. Mm-hmm. I mean,
who would want to do business in New York after all this? And then Governor Kathy Hochul was like, oh, don't worry. Real estate investors, this is just a one thing with Trump. Really? Is it really?
It's when you're at the hands, you exist at the hands of these neo-Jacobins. It's not just with respect to the big guys. As a New York City resident, Adele Andaloro found out. Adele Andaloro inherited her family's home in Flushing, Queens, after her parents passed away. She was in the process of selling it when she noticed a problem.
Oh, squatters.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, they don't leave.
Someone changed the entire front door and lock on her home.
Oh, my God. Here, this guy forced himself into
ABC 7, the ABC affiliate in New York, reporting here.
Here, this guy just forced himself into my house.
No, he did not.
Yes, he did.
No, he didn't.
And so did you.
Ma'am.
You broke through the front door.
Officer.
The man called the police on her.
So why is it that I have to leave and he doesn't have to leave?
Because technically he can't be kicked out. We need to go to court.
They consider this a landlord-tenant issue. And by law, it has to be handled through the housing court, not with police.
If you own this house, you would not want her inside.
I don't own the house. I don't own this house.
Exactly.
Yes.
She does.
Yes. But then once again, you should know how the law works.
I do know how it works.
There's rules to this. As you got to go to court and send me to civil court.
He says he signed a lease in October, but wouldn't tell us with who.
I got proof longer than that.
Show us the proof.
But who are you for me to show? I showed it to cops.
Dan with Channel 7 News. If you don't want to show it, you don't want to show it.
Cool. Come here, brother. I like that.
I would like to see it.
He didn't show me a lease.
This is a bill.
A bill for work he says he had done to the house. He didn't show police a lease either.
The police department doesn't have the lease?
No.
He's got no documentation.
Just bills.
So, Adele, you're getting arrested right now?
I'm being arrested.
For what?
For being in my own home.
And where's your lease?
She's fighting the house. It's not her house anymore.
My deed is current and legal.
Arrested for unlawful eviction. She changed the locks on a man who claims he lives there.
It's bigger than just the legal wranglings in a political context. It's this larger point that O'Leary was getting to, and I think the Andaloro case nicely illustrates. And by the way, we have the same problem in Cook County.
Oh, yeah. My friend, he had squatters in his house, and he couldn't get them out. I finally got them out.
If there's no respect for private property rights, you don't have a private economy, if that's important to you. For more on this, Steve Moore joins us, GovZilla author and economist, of course. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys.
What about that? What about the O'Leary formulation that this matter between the state of New York and Trump and the $454 million bond he has to post in order to appeal the ridiculous punishment that was imposed, that this is really an attack on property rights and it's an attack on America that extends well beyond Trump?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. And, you know, there was just a new survey that came out of New Yorkers about the condition of the city today. And New Yorkers are more, and this is a survey that's been done every 5 years for about the last 25 years. And New Yorkers are just disgusted with the condition of the city, the crime, all of the bad schools, the taxes. And the last thing New York needs now is to put a big, blaring sign out saying we're not open for business, that anyone who comes to the city and builds things and is a success, we're going to try to tear them down. So it's terrible for New York. It's every American, virtually, I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, realizes this is just a political witch hunt against Trump because they don't like Trump. I don't really understand the logic of this. It's, if anything, it's making Trump even more sympathetic to voters, and New York should just come to its senses. And what is the Eighth Amendment that says, the government cannot charge excessive bail? That if there was ever a case of a violation of the Eighth Amendment, it's here.
Well, walk us through, like, seizing of his properties. How's that going to go down?
Say that again?
Seizing of his properties. That's
yeah, right.
I mean,
exactly.
How's that going to work? Just walk us through that.
Yeah. What are they going to do, take away the building on Fifth Avenue? I mean, yeah. That's
I mean,
a good
kick
question.
Him out of Trump Tower? I know you live here, but we're taking yeah. over this place.
That's Letitia yeah. James is going to walk in, and she's going to say, "You're sitting in my golden chair. This place is mine now." That's where the AG's office is going to be relocated to.
It's almost like a scene out of the Batman movie, you know? It's like, yeah. we're just going to come and take your crap away from you. And look, she, every fair-minded person knows that she's not fair-minded. I mean, she right. basically ran for office saying, "I'm going to get Trump." I mean, come on, what kind of a judicial system we have today when you can just go after your political enemies?
Hey, I know you're feeling a little blue, and I don't want to make things worse, but I just wanted to commiserate a little bit. I'm sorry that a Bentley is delaying its all-EV plan and changing its vehicle development schedule, because I know you had your heart set on a baby blue Bentley EV.
I know. That was going to be so awesome. Well, look, the story of EVs is really a tragic story. I mean, you could make the case that the worst thing that ever happened for the EV market was Joe Biden coming into office and forcing them down the throats of American consumers. And so what you've had now is, in fact, we just had a little report on this, that in blue states and blue cities like Chicago, you have a lot of EVs. You know, half of the EV sales in the entire country are in, you know, three states, New Jersey, New York, and California. And then you go to red states. You know how many at the end of 2023, you know how many EVs there were in the entire state of North Dakota?
650. Wow.
650.
Well, you know,
wait, how many?
So 650 yeah. in the entire state. Now, it's a small state for sure, but, you know, so people in California, on average, are 30 times more likely to buy an EV than in North Dakota or Mississippi or Arkansas. And so what's happening here is EVs have become Biden cars. And so people, for ideological reasons, aren't buying EVs. And so half the country has said, "Hell no, I'm not going to buy them." It's like, if you buy an EV, you might as well put a Biden bumper sticker on your car. And so that's because there had been some healthy growth in the EV market. You know, these things have been on the market now for 15 or 20 years. And all of a sudden, Biden comes in and says, "You have to buy them. You know, you have to buy an EV. We're getting rid of gas cars." And what did everybody do? They ran out and bought gas cars before he could abolish them. So this has turned into a completely partisan issue. And it's almost like the EVs are now like, you know, Bud Light.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, in Illinois, it's Pritzker's demanding or encouraging, you know, of course, he doesn't demand the lockdown of lockdowners. He doesn't make demands. He doesn't impose mandates. He is demanding a million EVs be on the roads in Illinois, be in the hands of Illinoisans by 2030.
Yeah.
Well, we're only at like 95,000.
Is he going to buy them for people? Or
he may have to. But we're at 90.
You're so flush with money, you might as well just do that because you know.
Well, he personally is. We have 95,000 right now, so we're gonna and it's not exactly been growing exponentially in the last several years. So we're really gonna have to pick up the pace to make it to a million by 2030.
So the interesting thing about the car market right now is, you know what kind of cars people do want to buy and there's high demand for? Hybrids.
Oh,
you know,
I
hybrids,
love
but
no.
What's that?
I love hybrids.
Yeah, so, but you're like everybody. And yet the environmentalists are against hybrids, too, because it doesn't get us to zero emissions by, 2040 or whatever their crazy target is. And so, you know, if you're an environmentalist, you should be in favor of hybrids. But the Biden administration doesn't want hybrids. You've got to have an electric vehicle, and everybody's got to have one. And as soon as they started doing that, people started rebelling against it. And by the way, you know, if you know that they're going to abolish something, what do? You run out and buy them before they can get rid of them. So they've actually accelerated the. And by the way, go to a rental car agency. What are the rental car agencies saying now? Nobody wants to rent an EV.
And yeah, so they're selling off their fleets. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Well,
all right,
speaking of vehicles, what is going on with the gas prices? The average price of gasoline is up 40 cents since January.
Yeah. Yep.
We're looking at $5 in the city and $4 in the suburbs.
Yeah, and so this is a good point, because today is Fed Day. Yay! The Federal Reserve tells, that makes a determination in about 3 or 4 hours about what they're going to do with interest rates. And there was a lot of chatter about a month ago about the fact that they were going to start cutting rates, because they raised rates 11 times in the last 18 months. But no, I mean, inflation is back. I hate to say this. I don't want to ruin people's Wednesday, but the look at the commodity index, and gas is a big part of the commodity index. Those prices are up 11% since the beginning of the year. And so you've got a lot of inflation in that. The last two readings on the consumer price index show us that we're, you know, looking at 4 to 5% inflation again. That's a long way from the 2% target. And so for the Fed to be cutting rates now would be ridiculous. And they're not going to do that. But I think we have a lot of work to do to get inflation out of this system. And anybody who goes to the grocery store, anybody who goes to the gas pump, anybody who has to pay a mortgage or a utility bill knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Steve Moore, GovZilla author and economist. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Have a great day. Take care.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You know, you don't read too much into cultural touchstones, but sometimes they give you an indication that maybe there is a movement afoot, a movement away from the status quo. The American Society of Magical Negroes, that's a movie that opened this weekend.
Yeah, I saw the trailer. Ooh.
Yeah. I mean, David Alan Greer, who's one of the leads in this, who's actually really funny, if you remember him from In Living Color. He's actually a really good comedic actor, but he can only make so much of a script like this.
Watching you walk through a room full of white people was the most painful thing I've ever seen.
Excuse me. Sorry.
I want to take you to a job interview.
There's a recruiting class starting right now, and we got to get you in it.
Welcome to the American Society of Magical Negroes.
So I don't really understand.
It's easier to show you. What's the most dangerous animal on the planet?
Sure.
White people, when they feel uncomfortable. White people feeling uncomfortable precedes a lot of bad stuff for us. That's why we fight white discomfort every day. Because the happier they are, the safer we are.
The name needs a little updating, maybe like magical black people, or I guess that doesn't have the same ring.
You ready?
Oh, wow.
Your first client is a Jason Munt.
The movie made just $1 million opening weekend in the entire United States. It made $310,000 on Sunday, which was a 34% collapse from just Friday. Not much market for it. By contrast, this film I've mentioned before on the show, I'm sure people have seen it or certainly heard about it, American Fiction with Jeffrey Wright, who's, you know, really a good actor, and he was great in this. That was sort of a surprise hit, and American Fiction really is satirical in the direction of performative, whatever white liberals think black culture is. You know, Wright plays this intellectual, this academic, who is an author. And his books don't really sell very well. And then he sees the race hustling books where you talk in street vernacular or write in street vernacular,
oh, right,
selling very well. And so his literary agent convinces him to go down that path. He actually writes a spoof of that that is taken literally by a publisher. And then he becomes this massive success. And as he says at one point, there's some great lines in that film that's well written as compared to this American Society of Magical Negroes. he says at one point, the dumber I get, the richer I get. Or the dumber I act, the richer I get, which is also a cultural commentary. But it's just interesting. I mean, it's interesting that American fiction would be made in Hollywood and could get the star power of a Jeffrey Wright. And it's amazing, or perhaps it's amazing is overstated. Perhaps it's telling, perhaps, that what you would expect from Hollywood, the, you know, the most dangerous animal on the planet is the white person who feels uncomfortable or awkward or is suffering from low self-esteem because that's bad for black people. That's sort of the premise. You would think that that would be what sells based on what we're told from these same cultural mavens about the state of race relations. So I just think it's interesting. I don't know. Maybe I'm overreading it, but sometimes, you know, what people consume culturally is indicative of where their heads are at culturally. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Star Parker. She's the president and founder of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education and host of CURE. That's the Center for Urban and Renewal and Education, CURE. Host of CURE America on NRB-TV and TC-TV. She's also the editor of the just-released The State of Black Progress, Confronting Government and Judicial Obstacles. And a contributor to the soon-to-be-released The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic, which is edited by our friend Professor William Allen of Michigan State fame, as well as the lead author of the Black History curriculum that has been implemented in the state of Florida. Anyway, all right, that's a lot there. Star Parker, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're so very welcome. And those movies are a reminder of, A, why I don't go to movies, and mostly because I work here in Washington, D.C., so there's enough drama going on that are trying to fool the American people into unhappiness because they want to take control of their lives. But secondly, it encourages me to continue our work here at CURE because an alternative voice must be available for the American people when we think about matters of culture, race, relations, and poverty.
So when you, you know, the State of Black Progress, you're the editor of this just released book, Confronting Governmental and Judicial Obstacles. So which are the major governmental slash judicial obstacles facing black Americans?
Well, first of all, let's back up a minute because you mentioned the first tome that we brought out 2 years ago. What CURE is basically is an alternative to the National Urban League and mm-hmm. the antithesis of BLM, Black Lives Matters, because they have been promoting that narrative that you just articulated well about black life in America and this intrinsic now disdain for the founders and people of white or Caucasian heritage. So we have to have that alternative voice. So a couple of years ago, a donor underwrote us putting out the State of Black of State of Black America, which is about the pitfalls and the promises, historical look, academic look, the one that Dr. Allen edited for us at that moment. He was our COO of CURE and the long-term board member of our organization, CURE Policy. Well, the Urban League came after us immediately with their lawyers to say we needed to change the name, cease and desist, because they had trademarked the State of Black America, which their narrative is constantly from the 60s that there's something inherently wrong in the founding and therefore we need to transform the country. So we did change the name, as you're pointing out now, to the new one that's coming out 1 month from now called the State of Black Progress. And what we're doing this time is looking at the judicial changes in the country to actually move blacks toward freedom. And then we address what next needs to be done. The authors of the essays, we call it a tome because it is a compilation of essays from major scholars on particular areas of public thought. And Dr. Allen is one of the editors on or contributors on the part about the judicial changes, as well as Judge Janice Rogers Brown. And after they make their assessments, we then move into different policy discussions to where we should still be concerned. You know, you think about you guys there in Chicago. You hear Chicago, everyone thinks everything in Chicago is broken, whereas we know that everything in Chicago is not broken, but there are pockets of concern. In fact, when Donald Trump was in the presidency, we work closely with him to identify where those pockets are. And out of the 45,000 zip codes in the country, 8,700 are broken. That's a lot. 20% is a lot, but at least we can focus on them. And so that's what we look at through the rest of the State of Black Progress, is what should we be thinking about in these areas that keep bubbling up in flames year after year? What have we done wrong as a society that people will not mainstream, and what should we be thinking about? And in this particular tome, we're looking at health issues, housing issues, education issues, and economic stability. What do we need to do to help people get out of the rut of paycheck to paycheck and actually start having an investment in their country?
Well, so yeah, so these broken neighborhoods, I mean, I think we all understand, you've sort of by inference suggested what brokenness means. So then what are the fixes if government isn't the main fixer? You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
Right.
The war on poverty has been a total disaster failure, and government is the problem, not the solution, as Ronald Reagan told us way back then in the 80s. Well, now we can see, fast forward to today, that government is still the problem. When you think about the answers, as you're getting to, it's to remove governmental barriers over these areas in people's lives that they should control themselves, whether it's housing, whether it's health, whether it's education, and or whether it's what we argue in this particular tome is about freedom from Social Security, to allow people to put their monies into the market so that they can maintain a healthy portfolio to transfer to their children and or have a healthy retirement. So what we've done wrong as a society is continued this war on poverty for too long. It should have never started in the 60s. What we've done as a result is we've trapped people in certain zip codes to where everything in those zip codes is broken, from family life to educational life. Government controls all their interests, and all of their politicians are corrupted. They're singing the same song because they're social justice warriors who really don't like America. So that's really, in a nutshell, what we need to do to fix these problems in these broken zip codes is remove governmental barriers, dismantle the welfare state.
And for those not familiar with your story, I think we've had you on before, and we've mentioned that, but it bears repeating. I mean, you're a success story that can be modeled too. So you've walked in the shoes that many who are in these broken communities have walked in, and came out better for it.
You're absolutely right, and I'm glad that you brought up my personal story, because it is an example of what happens when an individual decides that they want to take care of their own lives. I bought the lie of the left that most that are trapped in these zip codes have bought, and now their lives are still in despair. The my problems were somebody else's fault, that I was poor because others were wealthy, that America's so racist I should not mainstream. And in listening to these lies over and over again without an alternative, it's why I built an alternative, you really can buy into unfairness on my life. Too bad, I'm just going to let it unravel. And mine did unravel, as many in these zip codes are unraveling. Criminal activity, drug activity, sexual activity. I was in and out of abortion clinic after clinic, and then landed on welfare. And it wasn't until a Christian conversion that I was able to change my life, pull it together, become responsible with my choices, finish school, get a degree, and start a business. And that business, when it was destroyed in the 92 Los Angeles riots, the Rodney King riots, the same thing we're dealing with still again today, transitioned me into the work in public policy to say, I'm going to Washington to try to remove these barriers so that people will begin to take control of their own lives and be able to have some dignity, some personal responsibility, and be able to live free.
And do you think that message is gaining resonance, or is it waning in relevance?
Well, you know, that's a fascinating question, because after I consulted on federal welfare reform in the 90s, and after we did that, we started seeing poverty rates drop because work was increased. And so people do buy ideas when given the opportunity, if you will. When we've been promoting for 30 years school choice, now it's the Black community, the poorest of moms, that want that for their children, to money to follow their children to schools that they want. The challenge is the social justice warriors keep standing in the way. When the nation was on fire because of George Floyd and his death, we actually ran billboards in those hard zip codes, including those zip codes up there where George Floyd lost his life that were very simple in these communities. The success sequence. You really want to get tired of poverty, then finish school, take any job, get married, save and invest, and give back to your community. And Black Lives Matter demanded from the billboard company that they take those boards down. Wow. They told them to breach their contract with me, or we're going. If you don't take them down, we're going to burn them down, was their message. And the billboard company then took them down and sent them money back. So to answer, it's a long answer to your short question that, yes, can people live free? I believe they can. Now, will they all be equal in how they live? Of course not. But the capacity to live free and to make personal responsibilities is a gift from God for every individual. But what we've done is allowed for government and demagogues to get in the way of people to make decisions for their own lives. We trapped them in housing projects. We trapped them in failing schools. We trapped them in a broken Social Security retirement system. We trapped them in government health care. And therefore, they're not being successful in their lives. And when people are under pressure and they don't think they have anything to live for, the blood runs in the streets, the blood of abortion and the blood of these young men who just keep shooting at each other.
Wow. And now with this presidential election year, do you think more Black voters are leaning towards Trump than the last time around? And if so, why?
All of the polling is showing it. I think what's happened is people actually can have a contrast now. I mean, when you ask, was life better but Donald Trump, the answer is yes, including the Black community. We saw after he signed the tax bill into federal law, we saw for the first time in the history of the country, more African-Americans make over $75,000 a year than under $25,000 a year. We saw poverty drop almost in half. And what we also saw was with the Opportunity Zone initiative that was in that tax bill, activity beginning in those broken zip codes that we talked about earlier. So these are the things that we are discussing in the state of Black progress, because the liars on the left continue with that narrative, have gotten away with it too long, and it's about time that most Americans have opportunity to see the other side of the story. Because if we don't, then we are going to end up in racial conflict. Most Americans now have interracial relationships, whether it's through their work, whether it's in their neighborhood, whether it's just their kids playing together. So we cannot afford to buy a lie that we're still in the 50s when it comes to race relationships. They're getting worse because the left keeps insisting that this country is racist. You just played some, I cannot believe those movies. Well, I'm glad you said the one is failing, though, because it's like,
yeah,
really?
Right.
Go again?
Right.
Really? This is,
yeah,
this is not where, you know, we should be in the 21st century.
Well, you know, I wonder something, too. I recently did an interview with Coleman Hughes about his book, his new book, The End of Racism. And one of the points that he makes, too, is that, and I think you're making it in part, race relations were improving over the last 30 years into the 2010s. They started to flatline. And by race relations, I mean whites thinking about Blacks, Blacks thinking about whites, not really thinking about race. And as you say, sort of being in community with one another because of the integrated nature of our society. And that's what we all want, I used to think. And now I find that some people don't want that, apparently. But what Coleman Hughes says, too, is around the same time of the Obama years, particularly the second term, where it was a little bit more racially charged, you had the advent of the smartphones. And so now you have, you know, one, we talk about screen time and kids and social media. But one of the under discussed aspects of this is incendiary incidents where a cop mistreats a Black citizen. They move at the speed of social media and the speed of the Internet. And now as now you're getting whipped into a frenzy and you have people then seize on that and say, look, the police are a systemically racist institution. Look at this video. Look at what happened over here. And then, you know what kind of conversations happen online. Oftentimes they're not exactly highbrow. And so that fed a lot of the deterioration in race relations over the last decade, even though prior to that, you know, despite prior to that, things improving, that it was social media as sort of a tinderbox for those who profit from racial division.
Well, that's true. I mean, there are instances, and they are broadened by the Internet, where you can pull an emotional politically charged issues and it been created groundswell. We saw that, especially with BLM hitting the national scene and raising that type of money and shaking down the major corporations that they did. But when you think about police reform, we never got to the real discussion. What the real discussion was that Tim Scott, this great senator from South Carolina, discovered is union control. When you think about what happens in unionized police forces, the poor communities get the rookies and the rebels. This man that killed George Floyd, Chauvin, I think his name was, had been under suspicion for quite some time. Let's just put it that way. When we look into what happened with Michael Brown, what was that young rookie doing in that community alone, a community that everything was broken and you got big, angry men? So union was a discussion that we should have had. But you're exactly right. When you can spin it around the world real quickly that this is all policing, then immediately you're in a whole new discussion to never really get down to the bottom line. And one of the challenges that we ran into and keep running into, especially with the progressive left that are heavily invested in social justice movement of Marxism, is that then they want to nationalize all the discussions. So right. What happened then was you go to the federal government, do something, and nothing was done because it's not their role to do. But you're absolutely right. When you fuel this type of frustration and people begin to get very angry, it's hard then to have relationships, in a broader sense. But what doesn't break down is the relationships one-on-one. When you think about the children of the baby boomer, that Gen Xer, they didn't leave their relationships that they have that are interracial. They just became more social justice warriors because they think that they're solving a problem that really didn't exist. The perception of racism is an industry in and of itself. And we saw that when you had even B of A doling out $1 billion to try to make it go away.
Star Parker is the president and founder of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education, CURE, host of CURE America on NRB-TV and TCT-TV, and contributor to the soon-to-be-released The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic, which comes out May 24th, but you can pre-order it all the usual places. Star Parker, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're so welcome, and that's The State of Black Progress that will come out. We have a cease and desist against using the word America.
Oh, sorry. Oh, State okay. of Black
we
Progress. State of Black Progress.
Yeah,
sorry.
I don't want to fight them.
Sorry, I don't want to cause any litigation. State of Black Progress confronting governmental and judicial obstacles. Very good. Thanks so much, Star. Appreciate it.
You're so welcome, Dan. Thank you.
Yes, what a lovely conversation. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'm just running through a list in my mind.
Of what?
Of
people you need to call back.
For what?
I don't know.
List in my mind of what we know to be true today, what many of us knew to be true in virtual real time, certainly after the first, say, 90 days during COVID. So the first night, so by the summer of 2020, and just like how comprehensively wrong the public health establishment, the political establishment, and the responses that were chosen, how comprehensively wrong it all was. So it's a flu that originated the Wuhan Virology Lab. You weren't allowed to say either one of those things.
No.
For which the faster herd immunity occurred, the better for young people, a la chickenpox. You weren't allowed to say that.
Nope.
Keep kids in school. Spend time outside. Don't return infected seniors to nursing homes. Keep people at work. Don't scare them away from preventative checkups. And instead, we pursued policies that were at odds with all of those positions.
Oh, on the list, too, that masks work. Mask stops the spread. Oh, and that if you get vaccinated, you won't give the disease or get the disease. Remember that lie?
Yeah, I mean, I know what the lies were. Yeah. I'm saying that the things that we knew and we said at the time, all those things I just rattled off, that's what we were saying. And now the New York Times is saying them.
Oh, really?
Sort of. New York Times, big think piece, you know, only 4 years later. What the data says about pandemic school closures. Oh, of course, they're always men and women of science and data. It turns out the longer schools were closed, the more students fell behind. It turns out that that even short closures had long-term consequences for children, really. It also turns out that closing schools, did not appear to significantly slow COVID spread. But, hey, nobody's responsible. Fauci and Birx were just providing recommendations. They're not responsible. They've cleared themselves. Trump and Biden were just following the recommendations of public health professionals. They're not responsible. They've cleared themselves professionally. And so have all the COVIDians that went along with these ridiculous policies in terms of the lockdowns, as well as to the barbaric behavior towards fellow citizens with respect to censorship, with respect to just interpersonal treatment, pushing people away from one another at funerals, excoriating a woman at a Dunkin' Donuts asking if you could take your mask down because I'm deaf and I can't understand what you're saying. Yeah. You know, we're all supposed to just chalk that up to mistakes were made. Because, again, if there's no accountability for thee, then there's no accountability for me. Jeffrey Tucker is the founder and president of the Brownstone Institute, author of Liberty or Lockdown, and he's got a new book, Life After Lockdown. That's Life After Lock Up, the show about prisoners who get... get coupled. That's different.
Yeah.
Life After Lockdown, not Life After Lockup. Jeffrey Tucker, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Sure.
So, the New York Times has finally come around. That didn't take too long.
I guess, but you know, there's something wrong with this model. I'm going to do great evil, destroy everybody's lives, and throw everything into upheaval, violate your rights, take away your religious liberties, your free speech, your freedom of association. Rob you of your tax dollars by not even letting your kids go to the schools you pay for, print trillions of dollars, destroy the dollar, bust the budget. And then 4 years from now, I'll just write a little editorial and say, yeah, well, listen, you know, everything cracked up to me.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's hard for people to, you know, to admit that they've been fooled for 4 years. I think that's the problem.
I suppose that's right, but I don't know. Am I wrong? I find these these articles too little too late, and I'm frustrated because it's admitting 4 years later that it wasn't that we weren't quite on target, it does not do anything to reverse the problem. And I guess maybe there's nothing you can do to reverse the damage. I get that. But, you know, it does frustrate me, as it does you, that we were screaming this. I mean, I was writing about this from January, you know, don't lock down. Because, I can see what was happening in China. And also I knew that there were some fanatics that had been extant for 15 years that were really anxious to try this big experiment on the public. And I was screaming about it, you know, don't do this, don't do this. And at the time, people were calling me up and saying, look, what are you saying? You actually think that the government would deploy universal quarantines, whether you're sick or not? And I said, well, you know, I'm not saying they're going to do that, but I'm just saying there are some people who believe that we should. And I'm worried that they're kind of, you know, they could gain a little bit of power and influence here. So it's a concern. Well, the worst possible thing happened. And we're sitting here with the results. I mean, and they're popping up in the headlines every day. I see that a new survey shows that the U.S. has slipped to number 25 in the World Happiness Index. These are polls that ask people if they're happy. I mean, people are not happy. The amount of weight gain, the amount of substance abuse, the learning loss. The learning loss is very obvious to me. it's all around us.
Yeah, right. Well, I like the way the New York Times, these New York Times authors, this treatment they offer, too. They, you know, the way this is presented as if they are archaeologists or anthropologists, and they've happened upon this period in American history where at one point the politicians did this, and then now we look and see the impacts 4 years later, and we're just here to report it. We weren't party to any of it. You know, our outlet, ourselves as quote-unquote journalists, we weren't party to any of it. We're just here to present what occurred as like a as an objective third party.
I know. I know. It's and it makes you crazy because, really, our listeners need to understand this extremely salient fact. The very first English language major news source that urged lockdowns was, in fact, the New York Times. And the date was February 27th, 2020. And that was the morning podcast where Michael Barbaro, the host, once a friend of mine, interviewed Donald G. McNeil, the crabby old lockdown, you know, disease hysteric. And he walked into the studio carrying a bottle of hydrogen peroxide and spraying it all over everything. So, you know, and in that podcast, they really did the opposite of 100 years of public health practice, which was to deliberately fan the flames of panic and hysteria. And I, you know, I listened to that podcast in shock, and I turned it off and I thought, you know, something is going on. There is no way the New York Times is doing this without some reason. They're reversing their own editorial policy that they used during the AIDS pandemic, you know, during the Ebola scare, during the 68-69 flu pandemic, or the 57-58, during the polio scare of the early 1940s, during the parrot flu of the 1929, and going all the way back, the New York Times has always counseled calm. If you get sick, see your doctor. Don't disrupt society. Everything you do to try to mitigate the spread of this thing will potentially cause more damage than it will fix. And that's what they always said. And so when they reversed everything, in late February 2020, I just knew that there had to be something brewing. And sure enough, you know, 2 weeks later, we had travel restrictions, and then the cruise industry was shut down, and then the rental moratoriums went into effect, and the printing presses started to run, and the whole world went absolutely bonkers, and we're sitting here amidst all the carnage, still trying to figure it all out. And you know what strikes me more and more? I was just, as you were talking, as you were introducing the show, I was thinking, just doing a mental experiment. What if we had never had a single article about this virus? Not one. No stories, no media reports, not one word of it. Like, we had just completely ignored it. What would have happened? Well, people would have gone to the doctors, they got sick, and the doctors would have treated this respiratory infection as they always had in the past, which is zinc, hydroxychloroquine, that's some ivermectin, a little vitamin D, get out in the sun, get some air. Everybody, there seems to be a bad flu going around. It doesn't seem to be affecting young people. Older people probably ought to look out. We would have managed it so much better if it had never been in the headlines at all. Right. If we had done absolutely nothing, if we'd never heard the word COVID, never heard the word coronavirus, never heard about SARS-CoV-2, except, you know, and maybe some obscure medical journal or something like that.
I blame social media on that. I mean, because remember back in 2009 to 2010, when Obama was president, we had the swine flu, and that was kind of hush-hushed.
Yeah, and that's because, yeah, and it was funny because all the same people who pushed lockdowns this time attempted to do the same thing in 2009. They were in Obama's office screaming at him, we have to lock down for this swine flu. And his response was, at least so I hear, was, I'm sorry, you know, we've got too much of our agenda right now on our agenda. We've got a financial crisis. People are afraid they can't get money out of their ATMs. I just don't have time to worry about your stupid flu.
Yeah. Well, you know, have you seen, because we had the documentary on this new film, it's a sort of a docu short called It Wasn't Fauci by Rob Monts, where he essentially makes the argument, and it's pretty persuasive, that Deborah Birx is not getting enough attention, that Deborah Birx was actually the lockdown architect, and she was the one who perpetuated the lockdowns, sort of manipulating Pence and taking advantage of dilatory Trump staffers who didn't read the guidances, which were received as mandates, that she was actually sending out to governors around the country. And she was going on tours, taxpayer-funded tours around the country, promoting these lockdown policies as well. And that she basically took the same approach that she had come to use to deal with AIDS and cut and pasted it and used it to deal with COVID.
Yeah, that thesis originated with Debbie Lehrman at writing an article of Brownstone, and I think it's certainly correct. She was the mover shaker behind everything, and she said in her book that she was falsifying data and releasing reports, you know, late Sunday evening, where she knew all the people who would otherwise be editing it, looking at it carefully, were drunk, and so that it would go out Monday morning. And she said that she just moved the data around, and she said brags about this in her book. So she was definitely the person. How she got that job is itself an interesting story. And as for Fauci, you know, if you look at his calendar of events, which is one of the things that came out during a FOIA request, he just did interviews all day. He wasn't following the science. He was following the media. I mean, he sat in his chair and lined up friendly interviews every day. He just loved the attention. Mm-hmm. Loved being the voice of the pandemic, but otherwise wasn't following anything. He was happy to lie. I mean, he was asked about things like natural immunity, and he said, well, you know, it's hard to say. We're still studying that. You know, we don't really know. And, you know, right. And his job was to buy time for the release of the vaccine, and then he used all of his power to make sure he delayed it until after the election. You know, the whole story is so horrifying, if you think about it. When you think that we locked down in March of 2020, and it was supposed to be 15 days to flatten the curve. And they chose those words, 15, flatten, because they thought it was alliterative and people could remember it. Flatten and 50, okay, fine. it's so embarrassing, right? And then it was like another 30 days, and then we had the summer of protests in George Floyd, and then it's back to lockdown. If you had known in March that the plan was to continue this until November, would have thought what kind of malicious sadistic leadership do we have? But the idea was to prolong the state of non-exposure or immunological naivety as long as possible, so that the vaccine would come along and rescue everybody. And that's why we had to slow the spread all the time and, you know, we had to stay 6 feet away from each other, and why we didn't want any talk about natural immunity, and why when Jay Bhattacharya came out with his May 2020 study on seroprevalence in Santa Barbara, showing that vast amounts of the population had already been exposed and acquired immunity, that study was shattered down. You see what's going on here? They wanted to protect the public and preserve naive immune systems so that the vaccine could come to the rescue. And this is why, are you following me? And this this is why the Great Barrington, listen, I'm telling you this because I only recently came to understand this. This is 4 years later. This is why there was such outrage about the Great Barrington Declaration, because this thing said, hey, look, you get out, live your life normally. You don't try to get exposed, but you will get exposed and you'll get immunity. Everything's going to be fine, but you've got to stop these lockdown policies. Well, that was a month before the vaccine was rolled out, and that's why they had to shut it down. You see? Because the Great Barrington Declaration said you should rely primarily on natural immunity, as we always have under pandemic conditions. That was a message they did not want to get out there, because the NIH and the CDC and the FDA and all of the other federal officials and institutions had become basically a marketing machinery for Pfizer and Moderna. That is the terrible, grim truth. But that's what happened.
Wow. No, it's really an interesting connection of dots there. Yeah, so we had alliteration to stop a virus, just like we have the Cookie Monster to stop inflation. But, you know, they're not infantilizing us at all, Jeffrey. They're not trying to. Not at all. Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute, author of Liberty and Lockdown, his new book, Life After Lockdown. Life After Lockdown, Jeffrey Tucker. Jeff, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.